Buck's Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. So good to be with you on this Friday morning. So to come on the program today, columnist Steve Flowers. Going to talk some state politics. But we're going to talk a little bit about last night's convention. If you missed last night's the finale, the grand finale, if you will, of the Democratic National Convention, held virtually at a laptop near you, all around the country. I'll talk about that and some other things. We'll get into that maybe a little bit more as this segment unfolds. Also on the show today, the 11 o'clock hour, from the state of Tennessee, Congressman Scott Desjarlais and State Senator Chris Elliott from Baldwin County will be with us as well. So make sure you stay tuned for that. Right before we went to break, get in the top of the hour news, we had a caller call in. Dave called in to ask about whether or not whether or not we should be looking at like maybe a Buy America provision. I'll be honest with you, Dave. I'm surprised somebody hasn't done that yet. With these, it's not, I don't know where you would, you know, we don't make these computers and these big items where it requires very specialized technology here in the United States. So where might you get that if not from China or Taiwan or some? Maybe you could do it in a way where you can't do Buy American. Buy American when possible, but if not, buy from a non-hostile act. To be honest with you, I'm surprised we haven't really... Somebody hasn't, some enterprising politician hasn't said, yeah, let's consider the possibility of putting some kind of statute out there if you're using state funds or you're using local funds, Buy American when possible. It's going to come at a higher cost. Is that okay? Are you more concerned about, the expenditure and the cost of the coffers for the taxpayer? All of these policy decisions have consequences. They all have different cost benefit analyses you need to take into account. And was it because of human rights violation with those laptops ordered by the state of Alabama? Was that a product of just China? Was it a product, could they have gone somewhere else and not had to face the same dilemma with the delay? Might that have been a part of it? How much or more do you think we as a state should be willing to pay for laptops or for computers or for anything else made in America or made outside of China? How much are you willing to pay? That would be my concern with it. But I guess it's kind of like anything else government does. The government thinks that they can stop the so-called threat to the world of global warming just by certain policy endeavors. Can you reverse a bad trend, hostile acts, bad behavior from the Chinese by freezing them out through cutting them out of government contracts? Or is it you're concerned about the quality of it? Well, you know, whatever that might be, but where else are you going to get it? What's the solution? Because that will come up. When the state does this, you got to realize there's going to be unintended consequences. When I say state, I don't mean state of Alabama. I mean the state as in the government does this and puts restrictions on where money can be spent. It has profound consequences in the cost and the cost to taxpayers. And maybe it's worth it. Maybe it's worth doing that. Like I said, you start making it where it's harder to do business with some of these states. With government contracts, it may be not just Alabama, it would take a bunch of states. Like, throw in Texas or somewhere like that. We're not going to buy any more Chinese computers. Well, you look at some of these manufacturers, I mean, their headquarters are in Silicon Valley, but their manufacturing facilities, very little of them are in the United States of America. So I absolutely think it's something to consider. And maybe that's how you break the Chinese and you make things a little fairer. Maybe it takes more than just tariffs. I think tariffs are probably the best way to do it directly. And that way you're not trying to be, you're not trying to do this in a roundabout way. But there's a lot involved. And look, I'll tell you one reason in the United States of America we don't have a lot of these big companies. The cost of labor is a big part of it. Labor is very cheap in the Far East. But you know what else they don't care about? They have relatively no environmental restrictions. You want to build a plant in the middle of town, you could build a plant in the middle of town, and you don't have the river keepers or the Baywatch or whatever coming in and protesting and filing lawsuits and challenges. The government of China just says, we're going to put it right here, right now. So that's another hiccup. And look, I'm not saying that we ought to change course. I think, you know, I don't want to live in a place where it's as dirty as China. There's goods and some services even are so much cheaper abroad than they are here. And what kind of jobs do we want? So it gets down to that. Could you do it in Alabama? That's always been kind of like, we have like, what, Tim Cook from Foley, Alabama. He's the head of Apple. And you always hear, well, why isn't Tim Cook taking, you know, Auburn grad, why isn't he taking care of Alabama and putting an Apple plant here in Alabama? You realize how many iPhones there are out there and how many MacBooks, Apple TVs? Think of all the things that Apple does. And they sub a lot of that manufacturing out. They create the technology. They go to China. They tell X, Y, and Z plant, Foxconn or whatever, how to build it, and then they work out a deal and they get labor over there for pennies on the dollar. Are those the kind of jobs? Are those the high quality jobs we need in places like Alabama and the rest of the country? Or would you rather have these service industry jobs? Or do we want something a little different? Building cars, assembling automobiles. I mean, it all depends on what kind of society you want to live on, but I would just add, you know, you want to take that out of the possibility of not buying things from China out of the equation, then you're going to have a lot of problems. Matthew text, I'm in the IT industry. Most every computer and tech product is made overseas. He says China, Taiwan, Vietnam, yes. Doesn't even produce the components to assemble these products. The big companies could move their manufacturing back to the U.S., but it would come at a high cost. Yeah, a very high cost. Like I said, you got the environmental regulations, you got the labor cost, you got everything else, the tax structure. And instead of paying, you know, like what's an iPhone X going for these days, $800, $900 or something crazy like that? Well, you'll just be paying $5,000 for it. It's unsustainable. You won't have the quality of the technology, because not everybody, very few people, if anybody, are going to pay that much for a cell phone, right? Aaron in Alberta writes, why doesn't the state build a factory next to a prison, at least to a manufacturer, fill the factory with work release, teach them a trade? Manufacturer will save a workman's comp, tariffs, employees. So I guess the gist of Aaron's text here is, why not use prison labor and train them how to do it? Maybe. But there's a lot of restrictions on what you can and can't do with prison labor. Maybe you could teach them that trade, how to work in a high-tech industry, but where are you going to work after that? Like I said, there's a lot of hang-ups to trying to do that and limit and restrict where you can buy these products. And if you want a computer, everybody wants a computer. Well, it's probably made in Asia. I think like 99% of them are made in Asia. Is that a problem? Is that something we need to look at, breaking up that? We always talk about bringing back that supply chain back to the United States. How do you even do that? Is it possible? And would we want to? Because all of this comes at a cost. It's not just as simple as, oh, Apple or IBM or whomever can just build a plant over here in one of these poor places in the Black Belt and Wilcox County, and then they'll have jobs and people will be better off. It doesn't really work that way. There's so much more involved. You got to train up the workforce, and then you got to consider just the environmental aspects. But it seems to me, we have these discussions all the time. We probably ought to start with something a little simpler than looking at these high tech things. We have really missed the boat on that if that's what we wanted. But the Chinese just have shown, the Vietnamese now, but the Taiwanese as well have shown they could just do it so much cheaper and so much more efficiently, and you could have these quality of life things that make our lives better. And I would argue to you, yes, while we don't like dealing with the Chinese, everybody would agree having the internet, having a computer in your house has made your life easier, better. You may have liked life without all these distractions, but there are some added conveniences here that have come because of that. So getting that supply chain back, what is that going to take? David writes, the only way to bring back manufacturing supply chain to the United States is a massive amount of investment in robotics and automation, which is going to create its own set of headaches, which is true. Getting the government involved in any part of the private sector comes with dangers. We're really, barely trust the government to deliver our mail these days. Do you want them to getting into the private sector and manufacturing things? Are giving companies the incentive to manufacture things, the public-private partnership, maybe in some ways for infrastructure works. Not so sure you need to want to. You really want the government to be building your next smartphone or being involved in that at all. So text us 251-343-0106. We're going to talk more about that. I kind of went a little long there on technology and manufacturing, but hey, watch these Republicans next week at the RNC, guys. They're going to talk about bringing home a lot of these manufacturing elements, particularly with pharmaceuticals, because that's one thing I think a lot of people will just say, hey, we just need to pay more. Pharmaceuticals are already pricey, but there's a weird economics involved with that, with the government. Anytime the government's involved, causes those prices to go up. That's why it's cheaper to get a prescription filled in Canada than it is in the United States. But if we're going to start bringing that back, we're going to start taking those that manufacturing out of China, bringing it back to the United States, or to a place that's friendly to the United States, I think is more realistic. That's going to come at a cost, too. Right now, you got to figure out some of these weird economics of pharmaceuticals and the deals, why you pay so much more for a prescription in the United States. Well, it's because, the government's picking up a component of that cost so they can raise those prices, and it's all built into the business plan. It's not good, but they would argue, these pharmaceutical companies would argue to you, it's how they are able to afford all this research and development with that extra cost, to have the best healthcare system in the world, the United States, where you have prescription drugs for just about everything. I don't know about you, but watch a lot of cable news. I see there are prescription pharmaceuticals for things I had never even heard of for ailments. Only in America, right? All right, guys, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Porsche Show on FM Talk 106.5. Sweet potato pie and I shut my mouth. Gone with the wind. There ain't nobody looking back again.
Hello, Kansas. Sweet Bill Farmer, let me thank you for your time.
And welcome back to the Jeff Porsche Show on FM Talk 106.5. Coming up in the next segment, my friend, columnist Steve Flyer, is going to read a lot of papers around the state, particularly over in Baldwin County. He's in a few over there, so make sure you stay tuned for that before we went to break, talking about bringing technology back and manufacturing back to the United States. Not as simple as it seems. I think it's going to be a big theme at the Republican National Convention and next week. We heard a lot about it. Going into the coronavirus shutdown, and there seemed to be at least a quest or a calling for some kind of justice here. Look what the Chinese did to us. Why are we allowing this? We haven't talked about that as much. And I know a lot of that is because of the national media cycle and the way they control the narrative. But I would just tell you, conservative media not really bringing it up as much as they were very early on. And somebody we're going to get on real soon, United States Senator Marsha Blackburn, to get her to talk about that, about kind of decoupling the Chinese manufacturing from the United States, particularly for very essential things. Where do you want to draw the line? Do you want your G.I. Joe soldiers made in the United States? Probably not. That's something where we'll find a lot of toys and things like that letting the Chinese make. But pharmaceuticals, a big, big one. And that is going to be just an incredibly massive undertaking. It's going to take tons of government resources. Just how much do you want the government involved in that element of the private sector? Because that would be my fear. We always worry about the possibility of socialized medicine and the government taking over the healthcare system. Well, they get their foot in the door taking over with the pharmaceuticals, telling these drug manufacturers, you have to make your products either in the United States or you could do it in we would deem to be an ally of the United States. Somebody that's not an adversary, perhaps. And we start going down that pathway, and then how much closer does that bring us to what I think would be just an awful, awful situation where you have government-controlled health care? It's just every little increment of that. It just comes and comes, and then there you are. You wake up the next day, and they're calling the shots from every angle. But I am certain that will be brought up at the Republican convention, which will be a lot different, I am told. Well, it remains to be seen how different it will be from the Democrat convention. But the Republican convention will still have some in-person proceedings. I talked to State Representative Andrew Sorrell today. He is the chairman of the Alabama delegation. They are still going to Charlotte. There will still be a gathering of delegates, albeit maybe social distance with a mask on. I'm not sure how they're going to work that out logistically, but that will still take place. That's the plan. So I think maybe six delegates from each state or something like that is what they have in mind, and you keep it at a manageable level when you do that. And you spread them out in a big convention center or in a stadium arena or something like that, and you can pull it off. Will it be quite as dramatic? But who watches? I mean, who's going to, you know, how enthusiastic can you be without the crowd in the background cheering everybody on? I keep saying this. I thought it was pretty cool, at least what Alabama did. Some of the other states did it as well, but Alabama really, I thought, kind of won it here. When the Democrats announced who their delegates were going for, Bernie Sanders and obviously Joe Biden, yet Terry still standing there and on the opposite side of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, opposite of Selma, and it was lit up, and you had drone footage coming in, and then all of a sudden the camera comes in on her. Having people in the convention hall, maybe not quite as dramatic, but at least there's got to be some kind of in-person activities. There was a little bit of that last night with Biden and the parking lot, and they had the cars out there honking their horns when he delivered his speech. But just to kind of put a period on this, that speech last night was, it doesn't seem like it was like what the Democrats needed to advance their position in this election. It's just they didn't lose any ground. He didn't stumble. Biden didn't stumble. Biden didn't struggle. Biden was able to at least maintain a foothold of where they are right now. They think they're in a good spot. Even if they don't think they're in a good spot, they're not going to indicate that they're not in a good spot. Kind of how that goes. At least the media talking the Biden speech up. Joe Scarborough say it was Reagan-esque. What has happened to Joe Scarborough? It's just crazy to me. But you go back and watch that thing a second time, guys. I'm telling you, you notice some subtle problems. He's stumbling on his words. I think a lot of people were watching it and they're sitting there waiting for that gaffe or that stumble or something bad to happen. And you're waiting for it, and it never happens. But meanwhile, you're distracted, waiting for that uh-oh moment. You're not really paying attention to the substance of it. Substance was not there. It was, like I said, it's almost storybook-esque or something to it. All right, guys, got to take a break. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Lonesome whistle blowing, and the youngins dream of growing up to ride. On a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind, but Mama tried. They began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. We looked down a river and we see the British come, and there must have been 100 of them beating on the drum. They stepped so high and they made the bugles ring. We stood beside our cotton bales and didn't say a thing.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5, 35 minutes after the hour on this Friday morning. So glad you can join us. Come up on the program still in the next hour. I'll make sure that you stay tuned for Congressman Scott DeJarlais from Tennessee and State Senator Chris Elliott. He'll be with us as well. A lot to go on the program. But joining us now, always a pleasure to introduce my next guest. He's a columnist. He's reading papers all over the state, including over in Baldwin County. Steve Flowers joins us on the line. Steve, how are you this morning?
Doing great, Jeff. Good to be with you.
Good. It's always good to get you on. First up, are you watching any of the Democratic National Convention?
Well, as a political junkie and columnist, I watch all of them. I watch everything political. I switch back and forth to the channels and everything. It's been the most interesting one I've ever seen, and the Republican will be next week because it's all virtual. But I got to tell you, I sort of like it better. They can make the speeches more concise, it's more formatted. I don't think they have a very big audience, but, yeah, I've been watching it.
Yeah, they have been able to limit some of the distractions, and I don't know if you're watching when they did the roll call with the states. I thought what they did with Alabama was pretty cool.
Yeah, I watched all of it. That brings me to this point. It was done with the backdrop of Edmund Pettus Bridge, but being an Alabama political historian, I'm not trying to be insensitive, unsympathetic to the cause of changing some of the things about bridges and things with the situation with the African American cities wanting to change names of different things, but there's a lot of history to the reason some of these buildings and bridges are named the certain things they are. For example, Edmund Pettus was a United States Senator from Alabama who was from Selma. He was a Senator soon after the Civil War, and he probably brought the money home to build that bridge, because building a bridge in that era was a pretty expensive proposition across the Alabama River. You know, so it was just also they discredited the fact that anybody was in the Ku Klux Klan, but everybody was in the Ku Klux Klan. It's like belonging to the Rotary Club or Kiwanis Club. If anybody who was famous in the South was castigated for doing that, then the entire thing was. The one that really bothers me, if they change the name of any of the Bibb Graves halls on the university campuses, because if you know Alabama history, Bibb Graves was the founder of the Special Education Trust Fund budget, and that's why every university in the state has a building named Bibb Graves Hall. If you go to every campus, Alabama, Auburn, Troy, anywhere, I'm not South Alabama, such a new school, I'm not sure they have a Bibb Graves, but he started it. You wouldn't even have education, African American or white, even in a certain period of time, weren't for Bibb Graves. I didn't mean to get off on that soapbox, but, you know, there's a reason some of these buildings are named that. And, you know, you have to consider now that, you know, it'd be the same thing if 100 years from now somebody wanted to change the name to an African American person and it became unpopular to have belonged to the NAACP.
Well, here's something interesting. You remember Parker Griffith? He was the congressman up in the 5th Congressional District. Uh-huh. Yeah. He says, why would you want to name the Edmund Pettus Bridge? Why would you want to name something for John Lewis that's old and dilapidated as such as that is? Why wouldn't you want something better, something newer, something that was reflected progress? Why would you want this old bridge built in the 1940s named for John Lewis when the idea is you want to show how we progressed? Well, progress isn't demonstrated through the engineering of the 1930s and 40s. It's at some point that bridge is going to have to be replaced. Why not look ahead and do something different, honor former Congressman Lewis in a different way?
Exactly. I agree with you totally. That's the point Congress has made. So he would talk to you on your show when you were in Huntsville.
Yeah, and we actually had him on yesterday for the first time. But yeah, we would we'd get him on, and he kind of gives you a good backdrop of what's going on in the Democratic Party in Alabama. He's still very connected to the state's Democratic infrastructure, but they sound very happy about the direction of the National Democratic Party right now, and then they sound very pleased with the Democratic National Convention, the way it has actually gone on. I'm skeptical of it and how it appeals to people nationwide. You know, maybe not just in our political bubble, but are they really doing much to advance their cause? But the Democrats seem very pleased with it.
Well, I think given the limits ahead on how you do things, by everything being virtual, I think it was worth watching. But having said that, I don't know whether I don't think it had the audience in past years that it may have had. And I do think, I mean, traditionally, the party after the convention has gotten a bump in the polls, but I was watching even a neutral commentator last night saying that that's not occurring right now. Of course, the convention just ended last night, so I don't know. It's obvious where the playbook is. The playbook is to try to take advantage of the disenchantment and the dismay of the COVID situation, which, of course, Trump wasn't responsible for, but he's going to have to take credit for it. I'll take the blame for it. You're in the office, you get blamed for anything happens. So, like you can tell, that's the playbook, is to keep Biden hidden and not let him say much and make a gaffe and just say Trump didn't handle COVID well.
Yeah, and that seems to be making a referendum on Donald Trump, but you didn't really give people much of a reason to vote for something. I know more people vote against something than for something, but you still need those people, I think, voting for something, just like you had people voting for Barack Obama, you had people voting for Donald Trump. While we were voting against Hillary Clinton in 2016, you still had a lot of people that just wanted to vote for Donald Trump. And Democrats, I don't feel like, have given the justification to vote for Joe Biden as much as they could have.
They do not. And I think the Democrats know that. That's why they only gave him a certain amount of time last night. He read from the teleprompter pretty well, but Biden in his early days was prone to have a lot of gas and make errors and do things, but I know that that's been one of the calling cards of Trump's campaign, the Republican campaign, is to discredit Biden's age and cognitive abilities. But you can't help but recognize that he's not exactly, I mean, he's all of 78. I mean, if I were handling that campaign, I don't think I'd let him debate. I think hiding out and not letting people bother him with questions and let him make a mistake is good. But if you get him on the debate stage, he's got to sit on the seat for an hour and a half and answer questions about it. Plus, he's got a 36-year voting record in the United States Senate that can just be dissected. Horribly. I mean, he's not going to be prepared mentally to handle that kind of assault. I mean, they may ask him about a vote in 1986 in the Senate, and he may not remember he was in the Senate. I mean, it's not going to, much. That's what he voted for or said. So I think that's a valid thing, and it may come back to see, because you may be right. More people do vote against someone, and they're riding that horse thinking that people are going to vote against Trump for numerous reasons. But you know this hiding out thing, and him getting out there and trying to debate it, maybe he's open to making a mistake.
Yeah, well,
they're hiding for a reason. I'm telling you that right now.
I would wonder this, though, if I think they're going to go forward with the debates, but if for some reason they said we're not going to do this, it would raise a lot of red flags, raise a lot of questions about Joe Biden if he didn't go ahead with
it. I wondered that last night. So I think they're worried about that debate. When I watched him last night, he was slow coming out of the gate. Now, he got a little better toward the end, and he was, but he still just doesn't excite people.
No, he's and he stumbles a lot. I mean, there's a lot of polishing that needs to be done to get him ready for prime time, it seems like.
And I don't know whether you can do that or not, Jeff. I'm not sure that when someone is in that shape and their mind is just in that shape, I'm not sure you can practice that. Because you don't know what's coming. You don't know what's coming in a debate.
That's something a lot of Democrats are really, really worried about, how the long game is going to play out. Hey, Steve, let's talk about something else real quick. 2022 seems like it could be a very interesting year in Alabama politics. I know we got to wait and see what happens on November 3rd to really know what could happen, but you could have potentially two big statewide offices open, governor and U.S. Senate, at the same time. Which leads me to this question. Like, who do you, other than, I guess, Will Ainsworth, John Merrill, the names we always talk about, is there somebody out there? Who are we looking at? What kind of craziness do you anticipate in that 2022 cycle?
Well, I can tell you're a smart political person, and you're already thinking ahead. And it, as a political person, I love it, because I'm looking at 2022, and I've been following politics a long time in Alabama. 2022 is shaping up to be one of the best political years that I may have ever seen, because you probably will have an open U.S. Senate seat, our most important one, and you could have an open governor's race. But on top of that, you've got all 140 members of the legislature running under new district lines, and you've also got every sheriff in the state running, and you've also got a lot of the probate judges running. And you've got two PSC members, and every secondary constitutional office. You've got one of the best races, and it will, as you said, and I hope you'll have me on your show to talk about it beginning next year, because the races will begin next year, because you got to realize that winning the Republican nomination in Alabama in these elections, those races I just mentioned, is tantamount to election. So whoever wins in the Republican primary will be the first part of 2022. So as the new year dawns next year, and this dust settles on this year, we've got a monumental year. Now, having said that, if Senator Shelby does not run, you have some potential candidates. I think you've got John Merrill. We'll look at it. He's term limited as Secretary of State, so he's got to go somewhere. I think that some of the congressmen, one of the congressmen, will look at it. I think either Mo Brooks or Gary Palmer may look at it. I don't think Adderholt is.
Yeah.
You know, for some reason, I'm not sure. I don't know whether I should think. I want to think Bradley Byrne has been so active in his post-final days of his term, and I'm not sure he's not thinking he may not be through politically. That wouldn't surprise me if he decided he wanted to take another run of that Senate race. And I'm not sure he wouldn't have made the runoff at the Club for Growth and not spent $700,000 against them in that primary. So, you know, Byrne can run, but the big question is that you've got some wealthy business person who has nothing better to do that wants to go to the United States Senate. They don't come open often, and they may jump in there.
Well, I kind of think that if Senator Shelby still has 2 years left on appropriations, and then that's contingent on Republicans maintaining control of the Senate, might he run again? And then the other big race, Governor Ivy, still, despite some stumbles along the way, still very high approval ratings. Might she run again? You know, you kind of speculating, what could we see at Ainsworth versus Ivy, Republican primary or something like that? But the Ivy folks feel pretty good about where they are politically right now.
No, I think when she first ran and was elected, even as late as the first quarter of this year, I was under the assumption that she would not run again, because I just felt like she was not wanting to do but one term, maybe. However, I've changed diametrically in that thing. I think if the race, if she can get around, I think she may run. I think between me and you and the gatepost, I don't think she likes the way Ainsworth has tried to encroach on her, and try to take positions on issues, and try to usurp maybe the governor's power or spotlight or whatever. He may be a little too ambitious. I think there's no question he will run for governor if she doesn't run.
Right.
He's running right now. That's where he's trying to grab the headlines and things. But I don't think he runs against her. I think if she's able to walk and get around, I think she could run, and they could just, you know, reelect her. And as you said, she's popular. And so I don't know, that race may not be as interesting as if she does run, as it would be if she was not over. But either one of those two brass ring jobs, the U.S. Senator or governor, always prospects for some rich person who wants to buy a U.S. Senate seat or governor's race, you know, that we ain't never heard of. You know, that may not be on the scene right now. But the big races, one thing will be the legislative races. You know, you forget there's a lot of power in those legislative races. Now, there's not too many Supreme Court races on the ballot. There's two of the state Supreme Court seats up. But it's going to be an interesting year, I tell you that much. Well, talk about, hope you have me on.
Absolutely. Hey, Steve, we're out of time, but real quick, where can folks find your column?
Beg your pardon?
I say we're out of time here, but real quick, tell folks where they can find your column.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, it's in all the Baldwin County papers and some of the counties above you there, the Scambia and Clark. The column is my column, but the website is steveflowers.us, and I urge people to read it. I wrote this week about the past governors, living past governors, and what they're doing.
Hey, Steve, as always, thanks for making time for us, man. We'll do it again real soon.
Thank you, Jeff. Have a good weekend.
You do the same. Call up Steve Flowers, ladies and gentlemen, joining us. We got to take a break. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Porsche Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Get loud. You can be loud and be proud. And you can be proud. I play guitar and I sing my songs in the sun.
Hey, welcome back to the Jeff Porsche Show at FM Talk 106.5. Good Friday morning to you. Silicon on the program. In the next segment, we'll hear from Congressman Scott Desjarlais of Tennessee. We'll talk about the convention, we'll talk about elections, and we'll talk about COVID-19. He is a physician. We'll also have State Senator Chris Elliott joining us. Let's talk about this push for a special session in Alabama, whether or not, I don't think it's going to happen, but I think you're hearing a lot of members, particularly on the Senate side, I say Senate side, I guess the Alabama legislature, it's on the Senate level, but talking about a special session in 2020 before the end of the year. And then, you know, we could go through the list of things that didn't get done in this previous session, and it's not so much that we care about the special session, but it does show there is some friction there, I think. A disagreement, if you will, between the House and the Senate still. Mac McCutcheon, the Speaker of the House, from Miles Stomping Grounds up in North Madison County, North Limestone County, does not want a special session. You're going to really need to win him over, woo him to get that special session. That's why I don't think it will happen. Otherwise, maybe you could pressure the governor into that direction. But a lot of members of the Senate think we need to consider this, so we'll get Senator Elliott on to discuss that. We're going to take a timeout. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Porsche Show on FM Talk 106.5.
left his living in a cheap hotel. The desert's quiet, Cleveland's cold. And so the story ends, we're told. Ponto, need your prayers, it's true. Save a few.